I don't think we could have squeezed many more people in here. So thank you very much for coming this evening, and I hope that you are comfortable. It might get a bit warmer as we talk further, so do feel free to take your coats off. We're going to be talking for about together for about 45 minutes, and then there's going to be time for questions, and then we'll decamp into the other part of the shop where you can have your book signed and chat further. But to do the introductions, I'm Catherine Lana, this is Browsers Bookshop, and we're really pleased to be able to present a very dangerous locality to you this evening with brilliant presentation here by Rob Lidyard and David Sims, the authors of the book, who are going to tell us all about it. And as I said, I'm sure you've got lots of questions that we'll leave plenty of time for. But this book, I understand you've been gathering information for this book for some considerable time. It's about 11 years, I think, you decided just before we came out. And let's look at where you've come from to do that, first of all. I need to say a little bit about you for people who don't know, though I think Rob is probably familiar to some people because he's written quite a number of books already. He's a professor of history at the University of East Anglia, and his specialism used to be something quite different from this book, so we'll come back to that at some point. David is an honorary research fellow in history at the UEA, and he formerly worked in shipping, I understand, before he retired and explored his interest in archaeology, and that led to this fascination with this subject. So perhaps first of all you could explain a little bit about how you first met. And you're going to have to keep giving each other the nod as to who's going to speak first.
I first met David when on the MA Landscape History at the University of East Anglia, which I teach on. He immediately marked himself out as a diligent postgraduate student. And this particular subject came about because David... he'll explain in a moment. He'd already done some work, in the field. But his dissertation, his MA dissertation, came to me, and I was supposed to supervise it because World War II archaeology. It's not Romans, is it? It's not the Iron Age. It's not medieval, is it? And because one of my research interests was fortifications. I'd written about castles. It got given to me. Because, well, you do fortifications, so, you know, you better do that. Bit of a Mickey Mouse subject, you know. Well, nobody's laughing now, are they? And actually, the work that David had done, the archival work, the historical and archaeological work, when I first started to look at this, and he started producing all these fantastic maps, I was blown away at the richness of the material. And for someone like me, who trained as a medievalist, when you're working in the 12th century... you've got a small number of sources that you're trying to bring together to build a narrative, and yet all of a sudden, all this material was just there. And I just thought, crikey, what can you do with this? You know, you can make some really good arguments there. And then it kind of started from there, from my point of view. So that's when we first met.
And how did you first get interested in the subject then? I mean, you were interested in archaeology. How did that develop when you retired specifically?
How long have I got? 2 minutes? I retired early, and I went to Sutton Hoo, and I heard there was a dig going on there, and I managed to get myself on it, and they invited me along, and I thought I was going to push wheelbarrows and spoil. And they were very kind, and they gave me a trowel. And they were professional archaeologists, and all I knew about was time team. And I worked there for a fortnight. I had some sailing duties after that. And on my last morning, I was excavating a thing which didn't quite look like a grave. It was too small or something. And I actually found... I came to the shield boss. Well, when they buried an Anglo-Saxon warrior, they buried him with the shield boss in his chest and the spear by his side. So the supervisor said, can't do it, close it all up, we'll leave it till after the weekend. And when I came back, that was finished. But I then did go on to dig for Colchester Archaeological Trust and Cultural Archaeological Group and so on. But then the story of how I got into World War II is another story. Well, I can say it now?
You can, briefly. Keeping everything brief.
I could go on forever. I went to a, not an exhibition, a conference at Southwold. This was at the end of the completion of the Suffolk Coastal Mapping Programme. And I was quite chuffed when a picture of me came up on the screen, working on a medieval fishing thing, anyway. And I spoke to one of the speakers afterwards. He was an archaeologist from the Suffolk County Council. And I said what I had done in archaeology and said, could I please come and research on World War II? And she said, certainly. And that's how I got into World War II.
And then he came to me.
And kept me on.
and that was some time ago, as we've established. So how did you come to write this book? Because there were a number of projects that you worked on before this book came together. So what were they? How did that work?
Well, David's dissertation was on the stretch of coast from Southwold to Alborough. And for various reasons, Walberswick is a very interesting place archaeologically and very well documented. And it's never happened before in my academic career and probably never happened again. I was given some money by the university to do a research project. To meet various agendas, which I shan't go into. Anyway, we chose Walberswick and we said, well, we'll do an in-depth study of the Second World War coastal defences of Walberswick. Yeah, and it started then. And then we did that. And then we said, well, actually, if you want to understand Walberswick, you then have to understand the broader kind of stretch of coastline on either side. So we started to do that. We then got some money from the European Union to kind of study coastal defences as part of a wider European project. Yeah. So we did some more research for that. We did the bit from Southwold to Alborough, and then we realised, well, actually, if you want to understand that bit, you've got to do the whole of the Suffolk coast. So then we did that. And then we realised, well, actually, if you want to understand the coastal defences, you have to understand that the coast was used for training purposes thereafter, so we studied training. Then we said, well, actually, if you want to understand all that, you have to understand the air war, because the Luftwaffe are flying overhead. And then once we've done that, we've said, no more, we must stop. And that's 11 years. So it all kind of snowballed. It started off small and then got very big.
And in that process, what were your expectations in looking at this landscape? And what were the surprises that to sum up, that's a nice big question, hopefully. Take your pick what you want to answer with that one.
Let's split that one. Do I want to do the surprises or do I want to do the what did you want to achieve? I think what we wanted to achieve was to get a sense of which the coastal landscape of Suffolk in the Second World War wasn't like that of Devon, Cornwall, Yorkshire. It was very much Suffolk's. And the reason for that came from the distinctive and wonderful topography of the Sandlings. Yeah, that was one of the principal features that makes the Suffolk coastal defences, you know, very much East Anglian. And also, I think, once we started to research it, the documentary material from the war is incredibly rich and it's incredibly vivid and it gives you a fantastic sense of the period. You know, the past is a foreign country, you know. And so I wanted to kind of bring that out more in the book, actually bring it to people's attention. And then secondly as well, from the archaeological point of view, we are very, very fortunate in this part of the world because of Minsmere and the other nature reserves, that the archaeology is incredibly well preserved. And so we really wanted to kind of make that known to a wider community, I think, that this archaeology is out there. You should treat it and use it as archaeology, doesn't matter that it's 75 years old, you know, and kind of bring that, I think, more to the foreground, and really a sense of how you can study this stuff. You know, it doesn't have to be just measuring pillboxes and things like that. You know, there's a kind of richer story here. So that, I think, was the ambition. If that makes any kind of sense? Does that make sense? Yeah? David, what surprised you? How much work there was involved, I think, is what you're probably going to say.
The number of times I went to the National Archives.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. So, what surprised you?
Well, I'd already been doing it. I think it surprised me that we found more and more. The National Archive is a fantastic place, and the more you go there, the more you find. And it's difficult to use at first, but by the time you've had some experience, you find so much. And I just kept going, really. And the thing about the National Archive, if you were looking at something called the War Diaries, which we use a lot, which is a record of each unit, what they were doing, is that this is written up every day, and it's so much better than oral history, because oral history is probably done written 50 years afterwards. But this is written by young officers at the time. And when we get a handwritten war diary, sometimes it can go to 5 pages. And they are fantastic, because they have a very good sense of humour sometimes, and they're also very critical. That's our main one of our main sources.
I might have a surprise.
Oh, yes.
Which was, again, speaking as somebody trained as a medievalist, I thought 20th century, I've got documents that aren't in Latin, you know, they're in English and they're often typed, you know, classically. I've got documents, I've got archaeology, I've got photographs, and I've got people who are alive who actually built some of this stuff. This isn't history, this is journalism. This is going to be a cakewalk. And I learnt something that I should have known from the start, which is the discipline of archaeology is great at shedding light on those aspects of human behaviour that don't get written down in documents. And also, and so the World War II archaeology is just as good as the Roman stuff when it comes to sort of things like that. And also, actually, how even some of the most banal things that never get written down, you actually have to use archaeological methods to explain why they look like the way they look.
So you're going to have to give some examples on that, though. I mean, we're saying archaeology. How do we understand archaeology for things that seem to be so modern, if you like? What do we mean?
I mean, I think it's sort of the broadly conceived the material archaeology. That can be earthworks, it can be standing structures, as well as sort of bullet cases. Or whatever. I mean, David did it. I'm not going to take any credit here. Do you any know hoist coverts at Walberswick? Some of you may know that. You've got a pillbox from one of the best preserved Second World War trenches from 1940 that you'll see anywhere. The documentary sources allow you to say who built it, when they built it, that sort of stuff. But they don't tell you what it was like. David and friends, arch excavator, excavated it. To see. We've got its dimensions. It's got a fire step at the bottom where the troops would have stood up. It was much more like a First World War type trench. That's an example where only the spade will out, and also you found that big cavity which you thought was a dugout, which you can then put with other sources when the documents say the men are very comfortable when they're sleeping at their posts. At least that's what the officers thought, We thought we'd excavated that. And do you remember you found that lock, didn't you, from that... from a door that had clearly just been liberated, nicked, or given over, and used as riveting in the trench to stop it from collapsing. You wouldn't get that from the documents at all, I think.
So you said that there's just such a wealth of information that you had to not plough through, but go through the archives, the photographs. How did you embark on it, and how do you decide which, how did you prune it to decide what messages you were going to present here? Because you wanted to present something new. There's an awful lot of information that's already out there. What was it that gave you the story for your book?
No. Bring that. Well, actually,
you're the speaker.
Oh no! It's a team effort. I mean, part of the reason why it took so long to bring this book to fruition, I'll be honest with you, I've never tackled a project that has had so much data. And actually, it was a two-man job over 10 years. I think if either one of us had been doing it, you're talking about a career's worth of work. Actually, I mean that absolutely seriously. And in terms of how we managed it, we gathered a huge amount, and then we did actually plough through it. We went through it systematically, and I would spend days at a time. I got a period of research leave, literally going through the documents and making notes under headings,
anything to do with the Home Guard, you're going to the Home Guard. Every time you find something in Home Guard, write it down. You know, that sort of. So you end up with this file of this stack of paper, which are just the stuff. Then you start sifting it manually to see what you think might be important. And then, between us in discussion, you make a judgment call as to what you think is important and needs to be in the public domain, and which bit you think, actually, it's very interesting, but it probably shouldn't go in a book. And you have to be very disciplined, I think. And let's just take one example, which is the one that always comes to mind. It's not a very nice one. Minefields on the beaches. I mean, it's just horrible because they get laid, the sea moves them around, you know, so the maps aren't accurate. Soldiers get killed in them by accident, civilians get killed in them by accident, dogs stray into them and get blown up, and, you know, that sort of thing. It's a very, very sort of defining sort of part of being a soldier on the coast during the war. You know, the minefields are dangerous, yeah? And you obviously have to write about it. You have to say, explain that people die in them. Actually, if you've got 12 examples, okay, then you just have to make a judgment call. Well, actually, what is most useful? What's the best example to communicate what you want to communicate? I was always told as an undergraduate, use two bits of evidence and that's fine.
Yeah.
And so we just kind of applied that, I think, which is partly why the book is quite a long book, you know. It could have been twice as long, easily. So really, it's a case of trying to use your academic judgment and as an author to decide what you think needs to be communicated to make the point you want to make.
And there are two things that you wanted to achieve with this book as well. You wanted it to be valuable for academic reasons, but you also wanted it to be accessible to people like me who would pick it up and read it, who haven't got that academic background. But what you were saying about the minefields, and that meant that you chose sometimes a personal story to highlight a point. Wasn't it about, you know, children might mistakenly go there, yeah, or the soldiers or whatever. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit more about having those personal stories as well as the nitty-gritty of the facts, I suppose?
Yeah, it's the... Are there any, while I'm doing this, you think of some anecdotes from a war diary, the ones you like. There are so many. The war diarist of the 11th Battalion Highland Light Infantry. I'd like to have met him, yeah? Fantastic sense of humour. Tells it like it is, and when spring in 1941 comes, he talks very vividly about the flowers coming up, you know, and the fact that the weather's changed, and he says, what will the new year bring? Not another Dunkirk. You know, it's really just, you know, that sense of tangible, you know, kind of a sense of what it was like to be stuck out in a remote part of the country in the freezing cold with not very good accommodation, not necessarily good food, but you're on the front line, yeah. You know. That really sticks. How it's not a very military, you know, thing. He's not saying the positions are all great or stuff like that. It's just a sense of being sort of... And that, I think, is one which I kind of warmed to him. And they have a row over the beach scaffolding, you know, which goes on the beaches because the Navy are supposed to supply it. Guess what's coming here? The Navy are supposed to supply it. The Army have to erect it. And there's one bit where he says, at the moment, what's he said? A battle rages between the Army and the Navy over the correct use of scaffolding. At the moment, the Navy are winning, I think he says. Yeah. And so it's. I mean, he stands out for me as a kind of... I mean, you might... Which bits of the war diaries are you?
Christmas with the AA unit.
Oh, yeah.
Christmas. It's very cold, there's ice on there, and it's been terribly muddy. And everybody's enjoying Christmas except the 217 lot, because their son has melted the mud, and they're now knee-deep in mud again. Just a story of what was happening.
Yeah.
But I remember you mentioning something about the fact that so much of the war is filtered through to us through films and TV, yeah, and store and books that we read these days, and certainly the Dad's Army thing comes up with the home front type approach. Yeah. How should we approach that image through your book? I mean, to qualify that humour, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, no, and Dad's Army is in there, it's mentioned a couple of times, you know, in terms of the Dad's Army humour. This is actually quite interesting from a historian's point of view. And because I'm looking at it here, I bet we've all, if I reel off some names of some films, I bet the vast majority of us have seen The Great Escape, Cruel Sea, yeah, Dam Busters, yeah. And the fact we're all here now is just testament to how much the conflict still interests us. We've had 70 years of post-war reinterpretation. And our view of the Second World, that Euro project that I mentioned, it's really very interesting when you go to the continent and you visit the D-Day beaches and things like that. But actually, it's a French, you're getting a French perspective or a Belgian perspective or a Dutch perspective on these events. And you suddenly think, crikey, I feel really English. I feel really British, you know. And so we've had this reinterpretation. What we've tried to do in the book, very, very openly, I think, is go back to the contemporary evidence as it exists written down, and try to, as best you can, forget about the post-war reinterpretation and judge it on its own terms. Archaeology is particularly good for this because the archaeology doesn't lie. Archaeologists can and frequently do, but the archaeology itself is just sort of there. So, and I mean, obviously, you can't. I was born in 1973. It's the, you know, I've grown up with all this stuff as well. You can't airbrush that out. But there are, when I say the myths, yeah. And I love Dad's Army. I should say this. I think it's fantastic. Even my kids like it, which I'm really pleased about. Yeah. Now, since the night during the war, but also since the 60s and the 70s. We've laughed, or many of us have laughed, at the idea of a German invasion. We think it's funny. Yeah, I can tell you now, from the contemporary evidence, no one is laughing in 1940. You look at the material, you can almost smell the fear. And so that's something which... And it reminded me of something of what my granny in 1940, when she remembers, she said... Bless her, going into a shop, and the radio was on, and the shopkeeper saying to her, the Germans are at Boulogne. And the fear, you know. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of see that coming through in the sources very, very clearly. It's very powerful, you know, very powerful.
And knowing something about the... I mean, because a lot of the things that... that we see in our landscape, we can sometimes take for granted because they're quite familiar to us, aren't they? The pillboxes, you sort of see them, don't really understand the context or the significance. And a number of other things that we're going to mention as well of these relics, if you like, they do make the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. So can you tell us a little bit more about the places that we can see that are still there and perhaps a little bit of their significance? You mentioned pillboxes, but how they're located and how some sort of overlap, if you like.
Yeah, yeah, sure. David, do you want to? I'm conscious I'm doing a lot
better than I do.
Right, chip in when I say something wrong, then, or something like that. I mean, and again, I'm speaking as a naive medievalist here. I used to drive past pillboxes and just think, okay, World War II pillbox. What on earth is it doing there? You know, and also you just think, well, isn't that something of an obvious target? You know, if you've got sort of a load of men in one, well, it's kind of, you just blow it up and that's kind of it. Of course, that's, concrete survives in a way that earthworks and barbed wire don't, yeah? And for many of the pillboxes along the Suffolk coast, as we explain in the book, they originally go with quite substantial earthwork defences, trenches, entrenchments. And actually, the manuals say... For a 10-man infantry section in action, only two of them are supposed to be in the pillbox. The eight of them are supposed to be in the trench that goes with it, but which archaeologically now we can't see because they've been filled in. Yeah. Also, we can say this quite categorically, I think, they are not placed randomly within the landscape. Okay, they belong to really quite organised and thought out schemes of defence, which we detail at some length in the book. And I think because only a partial number of them survive, that kind of skews what, you know, that kind of skews the view, if you like. It skews the kind of picture. We don't really appreciate that, particularly from 1941, after the panic of 1940 is gone, the army really gets its act together, reorganises the coastal defences, and there an awful lot of thought is going into citing their positions, and I think that's important to bear in mind. In terms of where to go to see them, Walberswick is the coast path south of Walberswick is the best place to see pillboxes. The other good place to see them is, do you know Oxley yeah. Marsh? Where's the at Dunboy Sluice? You know that very well. Well, wonderful. If you walk, well, I say this, you know, you'll be doing this all the time. When you walk up the sea wall, you pass the pillboxes there. They're very well.
But they're quite sunk.
They're sunk into the sea wall, aren't they? Onto the earthwork bank deliberately for camouflage and for protection. So it's not that they've sunk. They are deliberately in place.
They're meant to be in the walls.
They're meant to be in the walls, yeah. The other place is Bawdsey Manor. But, of course, you can't get in there legally. and, of course, you shouldn't even attempt to get in there illegally, should you? But those are the three places where you've got survival, not 100%, but good archaeological survival. A very quick point, if I may make, and going back to your surprise thing, I naively assumed that because the Second World War stuff wasn't very old, it must survive in great quantities. Absolutely wrong. Completely, completely wrong. They only survive under very sympathetic post-war land use, in particular, in this part of the world, as you might imagine, in the nature reserves. Nature reserves and archaeology go together. Yeah? Outside of the nature reserves, you've got attrition rates up to 100%. That's quite interesting. I don't know. There was a question here. I think. Is that all right?
Yeah,
that's fine.
Yes, near Oxley Dairy, you've got a mixture of First World War ones and Second World War ones. And I don't know how militarily they were connected with each other.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because
they used the one in the Second World War. But there's the one near the river, that's in very bad condition.
Yes.
And it's not really, you don't really go in there.
Yeah. But they do defend the same sorts of places. And we do talk about this in the book. Because obviously, if you forget about sort of airplanes and tanks, but when it comes to rifles and machine guns, the technology hasn't changed. Yeah. So the same sorts of places that were defended in the First World War tend to be defended in the Second. There was an issue, I know this in Norfolk, and I think it's true for Suffolk, but it's documented in Norfolk. The quality of some of those First World War pillboxes wasn't terribly good. And in the area around Weybourne, do you know Weybourne in North Norfolk, some of you? In the area around there, this is actually quite funny, yeah? Over the winter of 1939 and 1940, the army who were up there wanted to reuse them, but they weren't sure how good they were, so they test-fired, they shot bullets against it and kind of bits got blown off. They also sent some of the concrete to Cambridge University to get it analysed, yeah? And it came back saying, well, it's made of local material and not much good, yeah? So the troops then take them down. They demolish them over the winter of 1939-1940. Then when the invasion crisis hits in the spring of 1940, they start building pillboxes again, often in exactly the same places where the First World War ones were. So it's possible to go in Sheringham Park to a nice Second World War pillbox, and right next to it you've got the earthwork demolished remains of a First World War one, which always makes me laugh, because it's just so, how odd and British that you would kind of, you would kind of do that. It's got another.
There's also the longer defences. How were they used?
Yeah, when you say the longer defences, do you mean the scaffolding or the tank blocks?
There was one at East Lane, which is now nearly destroyed, but it is quite a. It looks like somewhere where you would have had. It would have been a lookout point and guns and all sorts of other things.
Oh, yes.
And there's one, I think, also on the river, the Buckley River, the river as it comes down to Shingle Street. There's another. Where the RSPB reserve is now, there's another sort of
bunkery
thing.
That was the training ground.
And East Lane. Okay, so at East Lane, you're talking about the very tall concrete structure at East Lane, Bawdsey, are you? And then
it was tall.
Are you talking about the one up the road?
We might see both.
There's one on the sea. One on the sea, which is actually being eroded as we speak.
But the really big one, where the car park is.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the remains of what's called an emergency coastal defence battery. Yeah. And that is a battery for a pair of ex-naval guns, which were taken off ships after the First World War, put into storage, and then brought back onto the coast in 1940-1941 in order to hit shipping 3 miles out. Mm. So that's what you've got there. That's a fixed battery.
And they were used?
They were used, yes. Mm. Yeah. Further up at you'll think about Boyton. That is the remains. We haven't talked about training yet. That's the remains of a tank firing range, a gunnery range. Yes. Yeah. Where you've got, and it's really quite good actually, so those blockhouses are where the targets were towed. They have like a little winch, and the targets are towed left and right, and then the gunners in the tanks then have to practice gunnery. And we know from the war diaries, don't we, that in early 1944, as you might expect in the run-up to D-Day, that is being used on a daily basis intensively, isn't it?
So do you want to say anything else about the training? Places, seeing as you mentioned it then.
David, do you want to?
Orford was a major training ground, and they started using that probably in about 41, but then it was taken over by the 79th Armoured Division, and they did all their training. They were trying and testing climbing walls, crossing ditches, and They really learned how to do it. When they crossed the Channel, they were able to deal with things properly. That's important. Enough.
And you know Wesselton Walks, the RSPB. You know when you walk up there, you've got those really weird kind of blown up concrete structures up there that are just off the path. Yeah. Now that, which we've kind of written about before, is one of the kind of the great gems actually of the Sandlings archaeology. That dates to a specific exercise called Exercise Crustion, which took place in the spring of 1943. And it was one of the first exercises, a training exercise, to inform the planning for the D-Day landings. And the remains of that stuff is actually the remains of a mock German fortification, strong point, that's known as a hedgehog. Yeah, because you know when a hedgehog is kind of feel threatened, it rolls up into a ball. Yeah. It's the idea of all-round defence, which the Germans had pioneered in Russia. Yeah? So what the British did, again, it's quintessentially British. Okay, the Dieppe raid has happened. That's been a disaster. Planners are thinking, how are we going to break the German Atlantic Wall? Typically British, they say, I know, we'll build a replica bit of Atlantic Wall and we'll practice. And we'll practice until we work out how we're going to do it. And what I know, it's bizarre when you think about it, but what you've got up on Wesselton Heath is the remains of that German hedgehog for this big exercise question. And even better, here's a surprise, which we didn't realise, and it's all in the book, yeah, is that the artist Edward Borden, yeah, who was a war artist, was actually up there during the exercise and did this amazing painting of it, showing the action that was taken, as flamethrowers and all that sort of stuff. And you kind of imagine, it's such a wonderful, quiet place now. I love it because there's no mobile phone signal. So, you know, the university can't phone you. You know, it's wonderful. Yeah. And then you're looking at this Borden thing and you're thinking, what would the RSPB do now if you brought a flamethrower up on the and just started flamethrowing everything, you know? But that's what they were doing in 1943. And there were a number of hedgehogs that were built before the D-Day landings. There's one in North Devon that hasn't been systematically looked at. But the Crustian one, the one on Wesselton Heath, is nationally stroke internationally important as an archaeological site. That is absolutely nailed on. And the RSPB are great, they're aware of this, and their management plans for the Heath take into account the World War II archaeology.
There's so much that we could be dwelling on, but we need to move on a little bit. So what about the perception side of things then? And something that you mentioned to me before, which I found really fascinating, was about the myths and folklore attached to the area, and certainly people's memories and thoughts about things that they believed happened in this area. Shingle Street.
Mentioned. I knew that was going to come up.
And we've got people, yes.
Right. Do you want to feel Shingle Street then?
No,
oh, don't do it. Right.
It is in the book.
Sorry?
It is in the book.
Yeah. Right, okay. Now this gets, you're taking your life in your hands when you come down to this part of the world and say the invasion of Shingle Street was a myth.
No, you're not.
We agree. Oh, you agree? Yeah. You live there, and you know it's rubbish. Yeah. Right, okay. If anyone's here who says, my granddad said he saw the bodies, then you can have an argument with him, because I'm not, okay? Now, we've got... Actually, this is I'm being entirely kind of honest about this. This was one of the bits which was just supposed to be a little epilogue, yeah? The folklore. And then I just got me hooked, because... As I'm sure many of you will feel the same. You know when you're out doing stuff in the landscape and you've come across a Bronze Age round barrow or something, and it's called Cromwell's Battery. And the local folklore is Cromwell put some guns on there and, you know,
personally fired them.
You know exactly what I'm talking about. And it's all rubbish. And you sit there and you think, how on earth does anybody come up with that? You know, it's ridiculous. You know, Cromwell was never here and all that sort of stuff. And then it occurred to me that actually, and I think it's because... we're moving from a time where the Second World War, people can remember it, where it's moving to history now. We're actually at this amazing time because it's becoming folklore. It's becoming part of our folklore, becoming part of our sort of unofficial history, if you like. And then it struck me that Shingle Street was a great example of this. Then, with all the other ghost stories we've heard, you know the big pillboxes at Blytheborough? You know, as you go down to Walberswick, some of you will know there's two big pillboxes in the field. Mm. We've had ghost stories about them, haven't we? You know, all kinds of things. There's stories about patrols going missing and their radios being found on the beach. Yeah, I'm thinking soldiers in pub radios. You know, we've heard the other one about people being snatched by German commandos from U-boats that have then been taken back to Germany and found in POW camps, yeah? There's this wonderful layer of folklore. And what's really interesting about that to me as a landscape archaeologist is that the places that have the Second World War folklore attached to them have a much longer history of folklore. Yeah, that's really kind of interesting. The Halsey Marshes, Willow the Wisp, the Dark Heart of Dunwich, all these sorts of... Black Shuck at Blytheborough, you know what it is? He appeared in a thunderstorm, didn't he? Came down, went down the nave, killed a few people, put his claws, fiery claws in the door, then was seen at Bungie 20 minutes later, that sort of thing. Well, how interesting, we've got a Second World War ghost story attached to the same place. One of my colleagues pointed this out to me, I was kind of talking to him about it, and he said, what... hundreds of bodies turning up on Suffolk's East Anglian beaches as part of a bungled invasion attempt. Yeah, that's first recorded in the 13th century. I chose the medievalist. I'm straight off to Roger of Wendover's Chronicle going, hang on, I went on. And indeed, there it is, the Civil War of John's reign. Yeah. Hugh de Boves is taking a foreign army from Flanders. He's going to invade England. They're scattered by a storm. Yeah, all the people they brought with them are drowned and their bodies are washed up, hundreds of them on the beaches of East Anglia in the early 13th century. It's uncannily like the myth of Shingle Street. But I find that incredibly interesting. And it makes me think about the perception that actually there are much deeper currents of how we understand the landscape of the Sandlings, deeper, got a bit spooky now, isn't it? You know, but just kind of senses of perception, and it's just wonderful how the kind of official and the unofficial histories merge so that we get this wonderfully vibrant sense of the war being entwined into that longer sense of folklore. Does that make any kind of sense at all?
Yeah.
Good.
I think it's very interesting.
Well, let's hope it's... yeah.
But also the fact that in other parts of the country they have different myths, like, was it the bombers? And we don't have any myths like that about ghostly planes or something.
Sorry, we can't hear you.
Sorry, you can answer the question by
yourself. Well, and then in thinking about it a bit more, try to think about, well, what makes the Sandlings folklore, you know, the Sandlings? Do you know in the north, in North Yorkshire and so forth, they've got spectral bombers? You know, kind of black Lancasters flying over Sheffield and things like that. And it's all dambustery kind of stuff, yeah? Whereas I thought in the Sandlings, it's quite interesting that they're kind of folkloric myths, are kind of connected with the military, science and technology. And of course, we've got Bawdy Radar. You've got the history of Orford with those secret clandestine experiments that took place with radar before the war. Then you've got the Cobra Mist, all the Cold War stuff as well. And all within our wonderful Sandlings landscape, you know, that sense of being remote, the big sky, it's kind of melancholic, you know, all those things that make this such a wonderful place. It kind of gives you that sort of sense of spookiness and, you know, government establishments and strange things occurring. And remember, again, you laugh, and then it starts to snowball, and then I suddenly learnt, apropos of something else, George Orwell, well known, of course, for living this part of the world, he saw a ghost in Walberswick Parish Church. And he wrote about it to a friend and did a sketch of where it was and where it went. Yeah, this is a landscape that makes people think they're seeing ghosts. And UFOs. I say that's in there as well. The other one is the Bentwaters Rendlesham incident. Absolute classic. Yeah, the UFO. You think something comes from over the eastern horizon, something mysterious, something strange. It's obviously quite unpleasant. It kind of comes here. Strange things happen. It's and you think. I'm remembering it all now. Sutton Hoo. Remember Mrs. Pretty, where she said she saw the ghosts on the mound? Yeah, this is wonderful, isn't it?
She was right.
And she was right. Maybe there's something in it after all. There
you go. Right, I'm going to open up to questions now.
Is that all right?
Yes. I've got a couple more questions, but I need to ask you for your questions because we're going to run out of time otherwise. Has anybody got anything they'd like to ask? She can speak.
Well, it's not so much a question, but just to add to your...
Please do, yes.
And bring the medieval with the modern together. We had a friend, long deceased, who had discovered the Ferriby boats in North Yorkshire, medieval boats in the Humber, as a teenage boy. As a young army officer, he was deployed to Rendlesham, and on his first night, his commanding officer came and said, good to have a new tank commander. We found the perfect places locally for tank practice. And he said, there's these wonderful sandy mounds close by. And our archaeologist friend said, you wouldn't by any chance be talking about the mounds at Sutton Hoo, would you? And the commanding officer said, absolutely bloody brilliant to practice for desert tank practice.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Ted Wright was able to save Sutton Hoo and deploy tank practice elsewhere. Because he knew about the immediate post pre-war.
And jolly good that he did. Because, of course, the Woodbridge training area, would, you know, the common, that's one of the first places they go after in 1940 as a training ground.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
So we're glad that you did it, but thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Did you, from all your studies, get any impression that the defences that were being maintained would have actually prevented an invasion?
We don't go into that in the book so much.
No, but you...
Because it's counterfactual. But we can... there's two ways to answer this. There's what they thought at the time and what we might think now. In 1940, there's a wonderful bit in One War Diary where they said the defences are all finished. You know, the enemy are sure to get a hot reception if they turn up or something like that. They're very pleased with them. In 1941, they're more formidable. But the idea of the coastal defence is they're never intended to throw an invasion back into the sea. They are there simply to hold up for as long as possible and to buy time. So the answer, I think, is yes, they would have been able to hold up. You know, no landing would have been unopposed. I think with hindsight, I think it's difficult to see them holding anything up for a very long time. In the words, which I'm sure we use in the book, of some gunners at Southwold who were there in the summer of 1940, they say, their words, for 6 weeks we expected to be annihilated. Yeah. So I think there's also another quote which don't use in the book, I've read elsewhere, from the Isle of Wight, and somebody said, we would have fought, we would have held them up, but it wouldn't have been for a long time and it would have been bloody. And I think that's probably about right, I think. So they would have achieved their objective of holding up, but not for a very long time. Of course, the irony is the more the coastal defences become developed, the less likelihood there ever was of an invasion. Mm. So in 1940, when they're at their weakest, arguably the invasion threat was at its greatest. In 1941, 42, when the defences are at their strongest, the threat of invasion is weakest. I think. That's a really fuzzy answer, but I think it's the best.
No, it's quite interesting because we walked along the Thames, and there's a line. Is it the red line or the blue line?
Yeah, yeah.
And we couldn't understand why pillboxes are all along the Thames.
Yeah.
Of course, that was another.
Yeah.
Defence to hold them up for a bit.
Yeah, it's all about holding up until you know where the main German force is, and then what's left of Britain's armoured reserves, three bicycles and a dog, is then going to meet the Germans in pitched battle and defeat them. That's the plan. Good job it never happened.
Can I just say, this is your intense study on this part of the coastline. What other studies are there on different parts of the country similar sort of thing?
Especially the south coast, where you don't seem to see as a tourist the same degree.
Yeah, it depends where you go, and of course. Studies have been done, micro studies have been done, of lots of places around the coast, from Scotland all the way down to Cornwall. There have been studies done of the big national picture, the major sort of national defence planning. What we wanted to do was to take that middle regional view, which is kind of big enough to allow you to see what's going on, yeah, but small enough so you can actually do it. Yeah, and so hopefully, I hope this is the case, what we've managed to do is to show how it can be done so that other people, if they wish, can do similar regional studies elsewhere. Not to take it as a template, but just to use it as a kind of exemplar of this is how you can write about this material.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
So that leads into my question, which is what level of government... What devolvement was there to decide where all the defences were going and what the plan was in this region versus the others? National oversight.
Yeah, the national oversight is, as you can imagine, the broader strategic picture. That's Alan Brooke, that very senior level. In 1940, the big discussion, isn't it, is whether the Germans are going to go for the south coast or go for the east coast. And there are long... You found a great one, didn't you? That long, great paper... South coast, advantages, disadvantages. East coast, advantages, disadvantages. They just don't know. So that's being done at the very high command. What follows on from that is that from 1941, two of the army's best field formations are kept on coastal defence duty in Sussex and Kent and in Suffolk, because they are believed to be the most vulnerable areas. Then it's the divisional commanders themselves who pretty much have to interpret the broad scheme of defence how they wish. So it's the very senior level is, do we need to defend Cornwall? No, or not very much. Do we need to defend Norfolk? No, not very much. I can't say that in Norfolk because the people get cross. But Norfolk's not that important in this, because once the Germans take France, it opens up the traditional invasion routes to England across the English Channel with the shortest distance. Yeah, up until the fall of France, East Anglia is seen as vulnerable. Because if you think about it, if you're going from North Germany, like the Zeppelins in the First World War, right, you have to go across the North Sea and then you end up in East Anglia. Yeah? So right at the beginning of the war, East Anglia is seen as really vulnerable. Once France falls, it's then seen as either or. So it's very high, that strategic level, but then once you get down to the divisional commanders, they have carte blanche to defend the area how they wish, and that's where hopefully what we've said in the book is... That's where things like geography, terrain, land use really start to become important in terms of where you put your pillboxes and things like that, I think, if that makes sense.
Oh, it does, thank you. Yeah.
Do you find that contemporary history of wars are always written by the winners, never by the losers? So having personal details from the diaries, I think, is a lot more honest about... The war situation.
Yes.
Don't you agree?
Yes, very much so. Very, very much so. And that's why you'll see in the book, it's large parts of it are written from the war diaries, aren't they? Because that's the contemporary evidence. And it's far more interesting. And that war diarist I mentioned, the Hyde and Knight Infantry, what did he say about these? He's been on coastal defence duties for 9 months. he said, makes the men dirty and ill-disciplined. You know, they have to be watched the whole time, isn't it? They have to be watched the whole time. Yeah, actually, if I make this, this is funny. You'll like this. Right, this is written. I know I'm talking too much, but this is funny, right? It's the when, because there are so many men on the coast, they're all spread out, right? Much further spread out than they ever would be in barracks or in action, okay? Which breeds petty insubordination, right? And there are these great ones. You always know there's a good memo when it starts, it has come to my attention that. and this is kind of petty ill discipline. The one I really like is the non-saluting of staff cars. Or, it's one of them, only saluting them when they've gone past. Which I just love the idea. You know, Alan Brooke is there touring the beaches as he does. Oh, look, there's the top brass lads. Better make sure we salute them or we'll get in trouble. Car goes past. After it's gone by, yep. Salute the staff car. That's great. That's the honesty I think you're kind of talking about. Absolute jeering at Italian POWs as well as the other one. Kind of amusing. I think there was someone over here. Yeah.
When did Alan Brooks take over the responsibility for East Anglia? Because he came in later on.
Yeah, that's right. He came in late July or August 1940. So after a lot of work by General Ironside has already taken place. And what Brooke does is basically slam what's done and say, this is too static, it's too much like... The buzzword is Maginot mentality, yeah? Because, of course, the army's got to explain why the BAF did so badly in France. Okay, the answer is partly blame the French, right? And blame the Maginot line, of the Maginot mentality. That's what we need to get away from, static lines, yeah? So what he then favours, actually, is a reorganisation and more mobile with reserves. And you see that very clearly in the 1941 reorganisation.
But he was a star. I mean, he went to be top man.
Yes, yes.
So it was quite an important appointment.
Oh, very much so. And the two things that Brooke is important for is, firstly, for reorganising the coastal defences. Secondly, it's his reorganisation of army training. He is really the person who grasps the nettle that if the British Army is going to return to continental Europe and beat the Germans in the field, it must... They talk about the training gap, is what he said. And that's why you get the Orford battle training area being established, the civilians being removed, because they're very heavy emphasis on battle inoculation, what they call it, realistic conditions. And that was Brooke, you know, from the top.
Yes, sir.
You talked about the Germans and German perception. I haven't completely looked through your new book, but yeah. I don't remember seeing any Luftwaffe pictures or saucers. And I think your four-volume set, I don't remember seeing any. I think your original coastal crust paper, maybe the one...
Yeah.
I think you cited a couple of Luftwaffe photographs that were held at Duxford.
Yes.
Yeah. I just wondered generally what your sort of angle was on the Luftwaffe, because obviously you think about how... For planning for D-Day,
yeah.
We probably knew more about the Atlantic War than a lot of the Germans did. So was it a case that very early on in your projects, you sort of went to the Bundesarchive or you went to Maryland or wherever, and in fact there isn't any German surviving material, or just do you think the Germans had no interest in monitoring our defences? It's strange how little they knew about Bordsey, it would even appear, although...
Yeah.
Look at the aerial photographs.
Yeah, for 1940 and 41, there aren't that many runs, actually, of Luftwaffe ones. There's the ones from, is it the 9th of July, the ones I'm thinking about. There's the famous one, I mean, you obviously, you know, sort of know this, you know Foote's book, Beaches, Hills, Beach, you know, the big CBA book,
yeah,
have you seen?
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got marked up there a Luftwaffe photo from 1940. Which is actually showing, you know, the kind of all the defences marked up there. So yes, the Luftwaffe ones we didn't trawl them extensively, yeah. In part because the National Mapping Programme had done a great deal of mapping already from aerial photographs from all sources. So we were kind of took the view that most of the data for our purposes was kind of already mapped. I mean, I know there are definitely occasions where, you know, sort of German reconnaissance planes are noticed going over, and things like track discipline is enforced, and at one point, I think in January 1941, work is stopped on defences because they don't want they realise there are reconnaissance planes flying overhead, and they don't want to give away what they're doing. Most of the Luftwaffe activity is sort of tip and run raids and mine laying, you know, and occasional strafing.
Talking about folklore, do you have a theory on the? Do you know about the Ju-88 that crashed at Wantaston?
No, I don't know that one.
But there was a Ju-88 that crashed at Wantaston in late June 44, just as the Americans were at Woodbridge,
right,
the Aphrodite Anfield program, and there were five crew members, and the police report talked about a camera being found by the original policeman that went on site, and then when he goes back next day, because there was a there was a body they never found, the camera's gone missing. And it talks about the police report about how they go up to Parham because they believe the Americans were looking for. I didn't know if you'd sort of come across
that. No, we have. I mean, the thing which in the book we could have, you know, looked at, but then where do you stop? Is the airfield ones? I mean, airfields get. We had to draw the line somewhere, and we concentrated really on it. Really, the book is what the regular army do. But it's wonderful that there's that kind of folklore-y stuff. We haven't come across that one.
Right, one more, and then we're going to have to break. Fred, again.
That's okay. Unless how much did Dad's army interact with the regular army, with the coastal defences, and do you have any documentary contemporary evidence?
Yeah, much of the contemporary evidence for the Home Guard was burnt by the National Archives after the war, as part of a selective programme of culling, wasn't it? All this material came in, they kept a representative sample. As far as we know, the stuff relevant to us didn't survive, did it? We certainly didn't
find a little bit in the record offices, we found some.
So the stuff in the Home Guard in the book is based from the regular perception of it, but we do know is that is it Sundays, isn't it? Sundays, either a full day or a half day, 1941, is the time when the Home Guard exercise with the regular army. Yep. That's quite good. They have an important role in terms of what are called nodal points, sort of slightly back from the beaches themselves, holding the defended villages. We do know from manning stats that they're very well. They're overmanned in some cases. As you start to go through the war, their equipment increases, doesn't it? And you will find both sides in the contemporary sources. You will find exercise with the Home Guard, they were pretty good and competent. You will also find the one which talks about exercise kangaroo took place, designed to test the Home Guard efficiency. The Home Guard, at least, appeared to enjoy themselves, including two old warriors who lay behind a hedge and who claimed to put out of action, what is it? A company headquarters, two tanks, and something else. Then it says, one of them was apparently used to a bottle of whiskey before breakfast. That's there in the war diary. So you've got both sides. In 1940, there's... You know, it's not terribly effective. I don't think they kind of mirror the regular army there. But certainly by the middle point of the war, when they're being given anti-tank guns in Albra and they're training up to use the coastal defence batteries, they're clearly not too Mannering-esque by that point of the war.
Right, we are going to finish now. I know that we could go on all night because there is so much, but obviously we have got the book to refer to, and there's lots of fascinating facts in there that I'm sure you're all going to pore over and enjoy. So we are going to move into the other part of the shop now, where you can talk to David a little bit more and find out a little bit about his research, because he's... I think you called him a truffle hunter, didn't you? Because
yes.
It was David's way of just pouring through so many facts and getting the gems that we've been privileged to get into this book. So find out a bit more about David from his research and Rob too, and get the book signed if you like. Hopefully you've got your copy of the book. We do have a few more copies if anybody has now been convinced that they should have their own copy. And also I'd like to just mention David, if you don't mind, in the front row, who's been followed your, was it Suffolk Guides?
Yeah.
Yes. So the walk through
different
archaeological sites in Suffolk, and he's now doing a project for a degree, and he's got some photographs of some pillboxes. So if you'd like to speak to David, he'll show you his photos. But anyway, so that's it for this evening. Thank you very much for coming, and will you join me now in thanking our speakers?